Thank you.
Thank you, Thad. I appreciate the introduction. Thank you for the warm welcome. I'm really pleased to be with you here today. It's a great day in America, and it's a great day here in Chicago, too, and I'm very pleased to be with you. I have to tell you, I just came from the Taste of Chicago, and I recommend you stopping over there on your way out. It's really good food. I mean, it's great food and fun to be there. Unfortunately, across the world today, in many places, we don't have good food. We don't have enough food. And I really am pleased to see here that this forum came together and brought such a distinguished group of leaders and leadership efforts from business and government to share ideas on building Africa's future. And make no mistake about it, investment in agriculture, investment in the structure of agriculture to move food to the market is an investment in Africa's future. You know, by the way, you're all having lunch. Please continue to eat. Clank your silverware, toast each other, talk to your neighbor, get up for seconds. As a former governor, I'm used to speaking to the legislature. But thanks again for the invitation to be here. You know, coming from North Dakota, many of you may not know that Theodore Roosevelt lived and worked in North Dakota, our 26th president of the United States. And I think of him as one of our most interesting and consequential presidents that we've had in our history. The years that he spent as a rancher in North Dakota are really not the best known period of time in his life. However, they were one of the most formative times. He went off to North Dakota on the day that his wife and his mother died, on the same day, and he went out to find solace in the land. He touched the land of North Dakota, and as he did, he healed his soul there. He was a sickly individual. He came to be a strong, healthy worker on the prairies. He raised cattle. He learned frontier justice. He learned hard day's work for a good day's pay. And he learned how important it is to lend a helping hand to those in need. As a North Dakotan, that definitely resonates with me. T.R. himself said, had it not been for my time living and working in North Dakota, I never would have been president of the United States. But, you know, it wasn't the cowboy life or tending cattle. It wasn't living out there on the prairies. He lived many lives. He lived the life of a cowboy, a naturalist, a writer, a politician, an explorer, just to name a few. He had broad interests and deep insights, but he was in the business of making people's lives better. He took a great interest in agriculture. As president, he continued that avenue. He viewed bettering the lot of the farmer as essential to the health of the nation. He said, to improve the system of agriculture seems to be the most urgent of tasks that lie before us. He said that in 1909 in front of the Country Life Commission. You know, it was true in America at the beginning of the last century when more Americans were engaged in the efforts of farming than any other pursuit. It's also very true today. As we see the global pressure on food prices and food availability, as we see population increasing at 50 million people a year, as we see economies emerging that are providing opportunities for people to eat more and eat better, we're seeing the frequency of purchases and the changing of food eating habits. We've seen the United Nations set a goal of doubling the food supply by 2050 to meet the demands that are going to be put on agriculture. And how important it is today to focus on that development of agriculture and the infrastructure of agriculture as we move toward meeting these goals. I'm glad to see that the World Bank is looking at things the same way. In its recent report on the role of agriculture can play in development around the world, it focused in particular on its potential for improving its life in sub-Sahara Africa. Agriculture already generates more than a third of the gross national product in this project, gross national product in this region, and employs more than 70% of the population. So it's well positioned to serve as the engine of economic growth, overcoming poverty and strengthening food security. The World Bank's concluded the key to success will be finding a way to trigger productivity revolutions among the landowner farmers in the area. I agree with that conclusion. And with the World Bank's observation that this revolution will depend on improved market access, stronger supply chains, better water and soil management, and the harnessing of the biotech revolution that improved crop varieties and livestock breeds that it delivers. Earlier this month, I had the opportunity and the honor to lead the United States delegation to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization's Conference on Global Security, taking place in Rome. Representatives of more than 180 countries and more than 40 heads of state came together to share ideas on what can be done to assure the world's food supply and assure that it remains stable and accessible to all nations. At the conference, the United States affirmed its commitment to meeting the humanitarian challenge of the world's food emergencies in both the short term and the long term. The United States has traditionally been the world's largest donor of food aid. Over 50% of the food aid in the world comes from the people of the United States of America, and we are going to continue in that role. In 2008 and 2009, the president has committed $5 billion to programs to fight hunger. And a good deal of that funding will pay for emergency food aid to help countries that have been struggling with the recent spikes in prices for basic food commodities like wheat and like rice. But that's the short-term response. Part of the aid will also go towards agriculture developmental assistance. The aim will be to help boost nations' assistance in production of key food staples and strengthen markets for trading them. That's the long-term solution for the reoccurring food crisis. We also called on governments to lift self-imposed restrictions on exports that block the free flow of agriculture goods and block farmers out from making investment decisions not based on the market conditions, but on government restrictions. The role of governments in supporting free markets is critical. Without a commitment to the legal framework and the physical infrastructure that they require, these markets are unlikely to flourish in a way that will help nations lift their people out of poverty. And that's why we applaud the emergence of the transparent financial markets in sub-Saharan African nations, such as Ghana and Ethiopia, Mozambique, and Tanzania. As well as the steady hand of good governance and the rule of law that are in place in many of these countries. The bedrock principles that are laid out by the African Union's new Partnership for Africa's Development are also of great importance. In agriculture, they recognize that the pillars of successful development must include improvements in infrastructure, in market access, as well as land and water management and overall productivity. The pillars also stress the importance of greater dissemination and adaptation of technology in reaching these goals. By embracing the global trade and expanding the role of the private sector, Africa is creating an economy that's ripe for investment and particularly in agriculture. When I was at the World Food Summit in Rome, I co-hosted or co-chaired a panel on why the food crisis and what can be done about it. It was interesting to see African country after African country line up at the microphones and talk about missing the Green Revolution, the ability for hybrid seeds and precision farming techniques that produced more food for many places in the world. It was missed in Africa. And their concern was it's going to also be missed with the new biotechnology revolutions because the infrastructure is just not in place. Small plots of land with farmers without good equipment, without good seed, without good fertilizer, with unknowing of water management, without good extension services to walk them along the way. You know, they missed out on this important revolution. And this second green revolution is underway today, and African nations must be a full participant in it. This is one is based on the, this green revolution is based on the advances of biotechnology. And it's given us new crop varieties that can resist drought and disease and pests. And it's not the only answer. It's one of the answers to increasing the real food supply in this world. Biotech crops can deliver greatly improved yields from land that's already in production. As we have seen with corn and soybeans in the United States, 50% increases in yields since the development of these crops. It also cuts down on that need for expensive fertilizers and precious water and pesticides as well. As a first step, of course, we need a science and rules-based approach that this technology is used that ensures the farmers worldwide are producing in a safe and effective way. Right now in Egypt, USDA is helping the government develop a regulatory framework for agriculture biotechnology. And Egypt has, for the first time recently, approved permits for field trials for several agriculture biotechnology products. The United States will continue to encourage countries to invest in research and development in these technologies. But, you know, as powerful as these technologies are, we recognize that no nation can make economic progress unless a fundamental human challenge of access to food and freedom from disease are met. In President Bush's first term, America doubled its assistance to Africa, part of the largest expansion of American development assistance since the Marshall Plan. The United States has committed to double assistance yet again by 2010 to a total of $8.7 billion. The bulk of this assistance will go to the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief and the President's Malaria Initiative, two of the largest individual health initiatives in history. Healthy, productive people are essential to productive economies. And there are encouraging signs that Africans' economies are becoming more productive. According to the World Bank, last year, the sub-Saharan African economies generated economic growth of over 6%. That represented the region's fastest rate of growth in more than 30 years. While oil-exporting nations grew the most, oil-importing nations in the regions also turned in a strong performance. Excluding South Africa, they posted a 5.3% rate of growth. When I saw these notes, I must say, like you might be doing, why would you exclude South Africa in the numbers? It comes to bear that South Africa is such a strong, powerful economy in the region that if you include it, it distorts the picture of what's going on in the surrounding nations. And so we remove it so we can see the true picture of economic growth and increased opportunities in Africa. And that is as I mentioned, the best it's been in 30 years. Most analysts credit these broad gains for economic reforms, greater political stability, and increased investment throughout the region. Stimulating new investment in Africa has been one of our president's top objectives. He has pursued it through the Millennium Challenge account that commits public funds and through the efforts to mobilize private investment, such as the Africa Financial Sectors Initiative and the $1.6 billion in funds supported by the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. These have led to significant commitments. And since 2004, the Millennium Challenge account has implemented contracts in sub-Saharan Africa with agriculture initiatives valued at close to $800 million. And two-thirds of the Millennium Challenge account of $5.5 billion will be invested in African nations. As important as these public investments are, however, one of the very encouraging developments today is that capital flows to sub-Saharan Africa exceed our development initiatives. Between 2001 and 2006, U.S. direct investment rose 52% to $13.8 billion. That represents decisions many of you in this room have been making about the market and about the trade potential that you see in Africa. And I would remind you that the investments that you make can be critical to the further development of agriculture markets in Africa. You know, when I sat there at that panel in Rome and I listened to the agriculture leaders talk about what needs to be done, I talk about that farm-to-market infrastructure development, it was interesting to hear them talk about market forces and the fact that they don't have any place to store their products to wait for the proper marketing time based on the conditions. They don't have refrigeration to take care of their products. Purchasers don't have refrigeration to be there. They don't have a consistent, safe supply of electricity to run the refrigerators. They have a difficult time of knowing where to sell their products and how to sell them. So, you know, when I look at that, I know that government can only do so much. And that's why the investments that are going into these countries by the private sector above and beyond and more than what we can do as governments are the most important issues out there. So I encourage you to continue to think of what you can do to improve the system through your businesses and through your personal efforts to build stronger partners and markets, in Africa. You know, it is great for me to be involved in these issues. I have an extensive private sector background and a great public service background. And it's great to have a foot in both sides of the equation. And it helps me understand the precious efforts that you do as private sector investment to invest in the future of the people and the governments and of these countries themselves. I encourage you to continue to do that, to build stronger partners and stronger markets in Africa. I'm sure that many of you are doing business in Africa today because of the opportunities of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or that AGOA has opened up. AGOA is further proof that in the long run, the best way to lift people out of poverty is to tear down the barriers to investments in their country. Last year, total United States exports to sub-Saharan Africa were double their level in 2001. Total imports here reached $67.4 billion, which is triple their 2000 level. That's a tremendous record of growth, but there certainly is room to do more, and the United States Department of Agriculture stands ready to help. Experts from USDA and the Department of Commerce are on hand at the regional African trade hubs in Botswana and Kenya and Senegal and in Ghana. They'll help you manage your agriculture exports to the U.S., and I urge you to take advantage of their great expertise. They can help you navigate everything from financing to sanitary and phytosanitary requirements to the rules of labeling and certification. There's a new success story unfolding in the parts of Africa, one where investment is spurring the innovation and economic growth. And what we know is that there are people out there that are hungry. We don't have enough food in this growing global population centers to feed people. And it's going to take investment. It's going to take a lot of investment from government and the private sector. But as I know from my position and my view as the United States Department of Agriculture Secretary, I know the people are ready. They're ready to go to work. They want to grow products. They want to raise animals. They want to provide food for themselves and for their neighbors and for their country and for their regions. And they can do it if we give them the opportunity to do so. And I know that you will continue to be that, and we'll see a new success story unfolding in parts of Africa where your investments are spurring innovation and economic growth. Let's pledge to work together to make sure that this success story continues. Thank you very much for joining us today, for the invitation for me to be here, and I think we have time to take a few questions. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pat.
And thank you for that pledge. I think we all want to join in the pledge that the Secretary has laid down for us. So do we have a couple of people ready for our questions?
Okay, thank you.
It's a rare opportunity that you have here.
You're taking it easy on us today. Yes, sir.
My question is, my name is Akinwale Ojomo. I'm a consultant with Roy Synergy Group. My question is regarding water resources issues in Africa. And I know that cannot be divulged from agriculture support. Is there any specific initiatives on the part of the U.S. government in assisting the local African nations in making sure that there's a consistent supply of water, not only potable drinking water, but to be able to support agriculture?
Yes, water is one of the biggest things that we heard in the food summit in Rome. And it's also one of the biggest things that we know we're dealing with globally is that precious supply of water. We're working at USDA to provide from our regional centers good water management, but it takes more than good water management and use. We've got to invest in the infrastructure of water delivery, of water storage and capture. But importantly, we also have to invest in the crops and the production know-how to use water efficiently in the production of food. We at USDA understand that that's a long-term effort, and maneuvering the USAID folks to look at, more investment. They got out of the infrastructure investment for a while, and we're trying to get them back into, and they are, moving in the direction of infrastructure development. The biggest piece of that infrastructure development is going to be water and water systems as we look at the supply. So I'm confident that we're starting to see a better focus on water and that it will be a long-term sustainable effort on that water development. Yes.
One more question.
Okay. Bill Jorn is my name. Incidentally, I'm a native of Nebraska and know your predecessor, Senator-to-be Johans. And,
yes.
I'm going to report that you, when I see him next, that you were here.
He was before your question.
Yes.
He was great when I was talking to the president about this job.
Yeah.
I called my predecessor,
right,
former Secretary Johans. I said, I'm a governor, you're a governor. We know how to do this. What's the biggest thing that you had to deal with? What was the biggest change when you went in to be the Secretary of Agriculture? He said, well, it's a lot like being governor. except you have a boss.
Right. Well, for the people here, I'd like to say that he will be a U.S. senator, and he's very interested in Africa, and he'll be sitting on the Ag Committee for sure, given his background. But my question is this. Can you speak concerning the subsidy issues, the Doha round, and how that really is going to affect immediate and long-term the relationships between the United States and sub-Saharan Africa on agricultural matters?
Yeah. Yes, I can. Thank you. And anybody else can jump in, too, by the way. The Doha round, the United States sees as one of the most important missions that we're trying to get complete before the end of the president's term. That means this year. We're committed to opening markets, to providing access, and to providing the arena for free flow of food and foodstuffs to the marketplace. To do that, we have to remove trade barriers, export restrictions, and subsidy payments to farmers that distort trade. We lost that battle with the members of Congress in the recent Farm Bill as the administration tried to move subsidies away from the trade distorting issues or the amber box projects into green box things like direct payments. We didn't do that. Congress, you know, lowered the direct payments and increased the countercyclical payments, which is just the opposite way we needed to go. But what we do have is a commitment when we see through the Doha round increased market access, then we can see our way to reducing the subsidies. And we have a commitment to do that. When we were working through the Farm Bill, we said, well, let's wait as an option until the Doha round is complete and then come back and generate a Farm Bill. Or we could plow through the Farm Bill right now. It didn't quite turn out the way the administration was looking for. But we can do a Farm Bill now knowing that we're going to have to change this and renegotiate with Congress once the round is complete. I'm very pleased with the progress that's being made after many years of languishing in nothing. I believe that the negotiators are moving well through the agriculture modalities. They're getting into the non-agriculture things, which are harder. But my sense is, from visiting with our negotiators that are there, as well as the United States Trade Representative negotiators, that we're seeing increased momentum and that we will hopefully see a ministerial soon. And if that happens, then we're confident that we can get an agreement by the end of the year. That will take a lot of effort on the United States parts to change our subsidy efforts and our way that we influence the marketplace. But the flip side of that, of course, is increased access, increased opportunity, and if we can get that, we think we can get the job done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One here. Oh, are we done?
I think we're here.
Oh.
I think your time.
Okay, well, let's do one more. Let's just do one more. What the heck?
He's the secretary.
Yeah. Somebody's got a mic. Go ahead. All right. Fire away. I hate to keep you all from your desserts. All right.
Thank you. And my name is Omar Diop. I run the International Trade Assistance Center to help U.S. companies expand their business overseas. I work for the state of Ohio. My question, I'm just trying to extend the last gentleman's question, and I would like to know what role the U.S. government is trying to play within the WTO in terms of subsidies to help African countries and African companies to be able to have a better level playing field in order to compete globally.
You know, I appreciate that question because that's a big issue in our trade negotiations. You got all the big countries out there, you know, with all the subsidies, and we're arguing about, you know, reducing portions of subsidies and kind of maybe, you know, doing this, but we don't really want to. And, you know, a lot of the smaller developing countries are being left out of the loop in this deal. But what I can assure you is, you know, if there can be a minimum good outcome of a food crisis. The good outcome is providing a lot of focus and attention on the developing countries and the African countries specifically, and the need to increase the opportunities for investment in those countries in the food supply chain. I think what will happen is, you know, we'll see that the lessening or removing of subsidies over time in the developed countries. We'll see the ability for the free flow of goods and services between our countries driven by market conditions. And we'll see some protections in the developing countries so they can develop the internal infrastructure that's so desperately needed. So I think there'll be a lag in the requirement for the developing countries to remove the restrictions and barriers so that you can continue the internal investment that's needed. That's my own opinion, but that seems to be where things go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Al. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And I believe this closes the conference. Thank you.